This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. When U.S. Colonel Morris Davis laid charges against Omar Khadr last February, he was a true believer. As the chief prosecutor at the U.S. military commissions, he was a vocal supporter of what his government was doing at Guantanamo Bay. In fact, when he wasn't prosecuting cases there, Colonel Davis traveled across the United States, preaching about the humane living conditions detainees enjoyed and the strong legal foundation of the commissions that would prosecute them. But today, Colonel Davis is telling a different story. He is now the former chief prosecutor at Guantanamo Bay. He resigned 2 months ago to protest the undue political pressure he says he was feeling from the Pentagon. And he isn't alone. Colonel Davis is the latest in a growing line of military and civilian legal officials who have stepped down over concerns about how the United States is interrogating and prosecuting its so-called enemy combatants and its war on terror. Colonel Morris Davis is in Washington. Good morning.
Good morning.
You laid charges against Omar Khadr and two other detainees at Guantanamo last February. How confident are you that Mr. Khadr will get a fair trial when the proceedings finally begin?
I'm hopeful that he will. I can tell you that the prosecutor is working on the case. You know, I know them very well. They've worked very hard on the case, and I know they'll do everything, you know, humanly possible to ensure that Mr. Khadr gets a fair trial. My concern is the broader outside the courtroom, the politics and how that's intruded into the process, and that's what causes me concern. But I know the prosecutors will do their best to get a fair trial.
And the broader concern outside the courtroom, what are you? You've raised issues of politics intruding, essentially.
Correct. I think you know, I resigned on October 4th of this year after serving for over 2 years as the chief prosecutor. When I took the job, I said I would keep it for as long as I believed we'd provide full, fair, and open trials. And on October the 4th, I concluded we weren't going to be doing that, and I resigned.
Well, a common complaint against the commissions is that the government was making up the rules as it went along. Is that fair?
Well, certainly, I think the chronology bears that out. If you look at February 2nd, 2007, is when we charged Mr. Khadr, Mr. Hamdan, and Mr. Hicks. On that date, there was no convening authority. You know, the person that the chief prosecutor is supposed to forward the charges to, there was no one in that job at that time. Also, the regulation for trial by military commission that really is kind of the deep-in-the-weeds guidance on a number of things related to commissions didn't come into being until the latter part of April of 2007. So I think the chronology shows that the train was leaving the station before the tracks were laid.
So why did you have to lay charges before all that stuff was done?
Well, we were getting pressure. I received a phone call from Jim Haynes, the DOD General Counsel, on January the 9th, 2007, which perhaps coincidentally was the same day that President Bush withdrew Mr. Haynes' nomination for a seat on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. But he called that day and said, "How quickly can you charge David Hicks?" And that, in my view, was kind of the beginning of the pressure to get this thing moving before the tracks were in place.
Well, what was going on behind the scenes with David Hicks? That's the Australian.
Correct.
Citizen who is now back in Oz, right?
Yeah, he is. In fact, he'll be released, I believe, on December 29th. He'll be spending New Year's Eve with his family and friends back in Australia.
As a free man.
As a free man. Yeah, we charged him on February the 2nd. He went to trial in March. We went down to Guantanamo Bay expecting to do a 30-minute arraignment. And we found out that morning that the defense and Ms. Crawford, the convening authority, had worked out a plea bargain on Friday night before we went down. And Mr. Hicks was going to plead guilty, and within 60 days he'd be home in Australia, and within 9 months he would be out of confinement and a free man. So, as I said, he'll be celebrating New Year's with his family this year.
Did you agree with that, the conditions of that plea bargain?
Well, we'd been having discussions. The prosecution and defense had met and had discussions about the possibility of a plea agreement, and I was never opposed to a plea deal in any case. I mean, I think as long as we get a fair and just result, exactly how we get there really isn't that important. So if a plea deal is appropriate, then I'm not opposed to it. But our discussions had been for a sentence. In my mind, we had a case here in the U.S., the case of John Walker Lynn. Was referred to as the American Taliban.
Right, I remember him.
Right, and to me the conduct was very similar, and John Walker Lynn pled guilty and received a sentence of 20 years. And I kind of used that as a benchmark. So our discussions with the defense had been for a sentence in the range of 10 to 20 years, and the deal they struck with Ms. Crawford was for 9 months.
Were you part of that deal then, in the end?
In the end, on Monday after, there's a signature block on the form, and you'll see my signature on there. But the final say-so, the person that has the authority to approve a plea deal is the convening authority, and that's Ms. Crawford, and she'd already committed to the deal. So, at that point, refusing to sign the document would have been, purely for show.
So John Howard was the prime minister at the time, good friend of George Bush, an ally in the war in Iraq. Was this political?
Well, I can tell you there was never any direct political pressure on me, but I think just if you look at the circumstances and the timing of it, I think reasonable people could draw that inference that, certainly I was following it in the media. John Howard at that point in time, which is, taking a beating back in Australia because, in large part, because of David Hicks. So I think there was, a lot of concern about him being a staunch ally and, what he was suffering back home as a result of David Hicks, and certainly some attention to try to make this resolve itself and take that off the table.
Now, you make the point that the regulations for trials weren't really laid out until about a month later. So did that influence the decision to negotiate a plea?
I don't know. As I said, we were not a party to the negotiations.
How unusual is that you weren't?
Well, we've only done one military commission, so we don't have a very substantial history to judge that against. But analogizing to a regular court-martial practice, that's very unusual. Normally, the prosecution and defense sit down and work out the particulars and then submit it to the convening authority for his or her review and approval. But here, the defense went straight to the convening authority. In fact, I think if you look, we were down at Guantanamo Bay the Sunday afternoon before the trial started on Monday. There was a press conference, and somebody asked me if there was any talk of a plea deal. And I said we had some discussions, but we hadn't finalized anything, and that, again, that John Walker Lind to me was kind of the benchmark. So I certainly wouldn't have said that on Sunday if I'd have known Monday morning there was going to be a deal for 9 months.
Mm. You mentioned Jim Haynes, the general counsel at the Pentagon, who called you about the Hicks case in January. Is his job a political appointment?
Yes, it is.
And you also mentioned that he was waiting to hear about a posting?
Yes, at that point in time, back in 2000, I believe it was in 2003, Mr. Haynes was nominated by President Bush for a lifetime appointment to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals here in the U.S., which is a very, it's a great honor and a great prestige to be on the federal appellate court. He was confirmed by the Senate Judiciary Committee in November of 2004, but shortly after that, before he came up for a vote of the full Senate, what became known as the torture memo and the torture policy came out into the open and became a problem for Mr. Haynes' nomination.
Remind us what the torture memo was.
It was a memorandum that laid out different interrogation techniques and defined what was acceptable, which included things like waterboarding or simulated drowning to induce one to talk. When I came into the job in September 2005, early in my tenure as chief prosecutor, I met with my staff and said, we are not going to use any evidence derived by waterboarding, regardless of whether you consider that torture or not. I don't consider it reliable evidence, and we're not going to use it. But the memo had laid out that that waterboarding was an acceptable and lawful technique that could be used. As I said, that memo became a liability for Mr. Haynes. Eventually, his nomination became the subject of a great deal of criticism. In April of 2004, there was Senator Ted Kennedy did an op-ed piece in the Washington Post that said because of his involvement in the detainee interrogation policies that Mr. Haynes' nomination could go down as one of the worst in the history of our country. At that point in time, Mr. Haynes was in the chain of command over the prosecution. So after this criticism surfaced, he rewrote the rules and took himself out of the chain of command. So when I came into the job, Mr. Haynes had no command authority over me.
And you say he wrote himself out of the chain of command over the prosecution specifically to distance himself in case he could still get this appointment?
That would be my opinion. He, when I came into the job, I came in 2005. It was in April of 2004 is when he wrote himself out of the chain of command. When I came in 2005 and continuing until December 9th of 2007, he pretty much had a hands-off policy and didn't have anything much to do with detainees or military commissions. And it perhaps was coincidence, but on the day that his nomination was withdrawn by President Bush is the day he picked up the telephone and called me and said, how quickly can you charge David Hicks?
You have also raised issues of others raising the specter of when to charge in relation to political strategy.
Correct.
Can you take us through that?
Yeah, I guess the first time that came up was on September 28, 2006. Late that afternoon, there was a meeting in Deputy Secretary of Defense Gordon England's office that included, I would say, 15 to 20 people. We had an election coming up here. It's called a midterm election here in the U.S.
We're aware of those when you have them.
November.
Very important, yeah.
Right. November of 2006, there was a midterm election coming up. So this was on September 28th, about 6 weeks out from the midterm elections. And Deputy Secretary of Defense England said, you know, talking to the group now, he said, you know, we really got to think about, who we can charge and what we could charge them with and when we could charge them, because if we can get some of these charges out quickly, it could have some strategic political value. Now, to his credit, Mr. Haynes at that point chimed in that, look, that's not for this group to decide. That's for the chief prosecutor.
Why is that kind of suggestion so abhorrent to you?
Well, these are supposed to be military commissions where we are hopefully to have full, fair, and open trials and to do justice. This isn't a process intended to try to influence or shape political outcomes. And to me, as the chief prosecutor, you prepare a case, and when the case is ready, if the facts are there, then you charge the individual and you go to trial, but you don't base that decision on potential political consequences as based on the evidence.
And so later, when Jim Haynes called you about David Hicks, he wasn't the only one you charged when you charged Hicks. That's when you charged Cotter as well.
Right.
And was that in relation to that? How are those two, why did they happen at the same time?
So Mr. Haynes called on January 9th. He specifically asked about David Hicks, but then he said, are there other cases you could charge as well? He didn't say why, but, my assumption was that it was going to look odd. You know, there was a lot of pressure on the Howard administration because of the Hicks case, and it was going to look odd if we just charged David Hicks. It would not look quite as odd if it was one of several cases rather than a case by itself. And quite honestly, it really was no problem. There were four or five or six cases that were potential candidates, so charging Cotter, Homden, and Hicks all at the same time, all the cases were ripe and ready for trial. Again, the problem was at that point in time, there was no convening authority and no regulation for trial by military commissions.
So if you had had your way, would you have waited until all of those other processes were in place?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you need to know what the rules are before you start. So, as the defense and some of the critics said, the government was trying to get the train out of the station before laying the tracks, and that's probably a pretty fair analogy.
So why did you resign in the end?
I feel that the prosecution needs to be totally independent from the other parts of the commission process. I think all the parts need to be separate and independent. We had a new legal advisor to the convening authority that came in July of 2007. Under the old system, Brigadier General Tom Hemingway had a very hands-off approach, because I think his view was if he was going to provide independent advice to the convening authority, he couldn't be too close to the prosecution or the defense. His replacement, the new legal advisor, while I was out having surgery, came in and started assigning prosecutors, reviewing evidence, working on charges, which to me, I think, exceeded what's allowed by the Military Commissions Act. Second, the new legal advisor and the new convening authority, to get evidence declassified for use in open trial takes a lot of time and effort. Their view was that we have a statute and we have rules that permit closed proceedings, so we didn't need to waste time on the declassification process, that we needed to get things up and running, get cases tried, and not worry about keeping the hearings open when we had rules that allowed for closed proceedings. In my view, that's just the wrong sight picture. You can have the most perfect trial in the history of the world, but if you do it in secret behind closed doors, there are going to be a lot of skeptics that question whether it was a fair trial. So I think it's imperative these trials be open and transparent. And then the final straw was the memo from Deputy Secretary of Defense England on October the 4th that put Mr. Haynes in a command position with authority to issue orders to me as the chief prosecutor. And that was the final straw, and I resigned.
So I just want to make sure I understand. You believe these prisoners should be charged. Your concerns have to do with the process.
Exactly. It's unfortunate. I mean, I think one thing that everyone needs to understand is there are some truly bad men at Guantanamo Bay who deserve to be held accountable for their conduct. But we need to ensure that we hold them accountable in a process that that supports our notion of what's right. And my concern is, as long as politics are injected into this process, that's going to be in doubt. If these truly are military commissions, the military should be running this process. Towards the end, I begin to feel like Mickey Mouse at Disney World. You know, if you go to Disney World, it wouldn't be Disney if Mickey wasn't there. So somebody's got to put on the costume and go out front occasionally and wave at the crowd, or it's not going to seem like Disney. But Mickey Mouse didn't get a seat in the boardroom. It began to feel that way for me, that these were being billed as military commissions, so somebody had to put on the military costume and stand out front, or it was going to look like a sham. But that didn't mean that the military had any say-so or authority in how these were conducted. It seemed that politics were taking the driver's seat and moving these things forward.
You know, I want to explore this whole issue because you are now one of a handful of legal insiders who support the U.S. war on terror and even the use of Guantanamo, but have become uncomfortable with the laws that are used or abused in some cases, in some people's views, in the prosecution of the war on terror. And I'm thinking of the head of Office of Legal Counsel, Jack Goldsmith, who resigned, Alberto Mora, the general counsel for the U.S. Navy, who resigned, Lieutenant Colonel Colby Volkey, the Marine Corps Chief of Defense Lawyers, and also Lieutenant Colonel V. Stewart Crouch, who resigned as prosecutor at Guantanamo. What's the message?
Well, I'd hope the message you could take from that is that somebody in a position to do something, somebody with the authority, ought to take a hard look at what's going on and ask themselves why. Or, you know, if it was just me, and I think you could write it off as, you know, one malcontent, but that list that you ran through, and there are others, I think when you look at that many good people, you have to stop and ask, you know, well, what's going on here?
So you want to be tough on these prisoners, and you want to charge them, but you don't want to go beyond the scope of the legal system.
Exactly. I mean, in my opinion, there are some people at Guantanamo Bay that I think we have the evidence to prove their guilt, and they ought to be executed for some of the things that they've done. Now, that doesn't apply to everyone, but there are some that I believe warrant the death penalty. So, yes, I believe very strongly there are some very bad people at Guantanamo Bay. But I think, Senator John McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham have said here, the way we do this says as much about us, if not more, than it does about them, and we've got to do this right.
I want to ask you a bit more about Omar Khadr. He was 15 years old when he was captured in Afghanistan. How concerned were you about his age when you were building a case against him?
Not at all. I know the questions come up about him being a child soldier. Mr. Khadr was 15 years and 10 months of age at the time he was captured in Afghanistan. If you look at the Convention on the Rights of the Child in Article 37, there's a specific provision in there that says anyone under the age of 18 may not be sentenced to death or confinement for life. Mr. Cotter's case was not referred as a death penalty case, and at least when I was the chief prosecutor, we had no intention of arguing for a life sentence. So even though we're not a party to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, we were in full compliance with it. If you look at some of the international tribunals, as you may know, former Liberian President Charles Taylor is on trial at The Hague right now, and one of the things he's charged with is using child soldiers in armed conflict. The definition of a child soldier is anyone who has not yet attained the age of 15 years. So if Charles Taylor had signed Omar Khadr up to fight for his team, that would not have been a crime. He wouldn't be on trial for using Omar Khadr because he doesn't meet the definition of a child soldier. So in my view, if you look in both your country and here in the U.S., there are literally thousands of individuals that are incarcerated or have been incarcerated for crimes committed when they were the same age as Omar Khadr. So I don't think he should avoid liability just because of where he committed his offense.
Are there changes you think have to be made to the military commissions to ensure that he and others are guaranteed a fair trial?
Yes, I believe that, as I said, I think the Military Commissions Act is a very commendable piece of legislation, and I think if it was faithfully executed that we could have trials that we could look back on and feel good about that we have done this right. As I said, I think Congress gave us the right tools. It's the implementation by some political appointees that want to try to ensure outcomes that, in my view, are circumventing justice.
Well, given the controversy around this, why doesn't Washington just let you do your job then?
That's a good question. I wish I knew the answer to that. I guess the one thing I'd hoped for when I resigned, that it would generate some attention and that somebody that had the authority to do something would step in and fix this. One thing DOD did a very effective job on. One of my big gripes was on the public diplomacy front, we did a terrible job of talking about Guantanamo Bay and talking about military commissions, and that's one reason. You know, I went around the country giving a lot of talks, and I wrote articles. The one you mentioned in the New York Times, I did an article in the Yale Law Journal in August of this year. 52 days before I resigned, I wrote an article called In Defense of Guantanamo. And I think we did a terrible job on the public diplomacy front, but the one thing DOD did right was the day I resigned, within an hour, they issued a gag order prohibiting me from talking to the media. Then they waited till the next day, which was a Friday, and held a press conference to announce that I'd resigned, which was a Friday before a three-day holiday weekend. And then, you know, when the following week came, I was still under the gag order, so they effectively kept me under wraps until, you know, kind of the interest blew over. And they've done a very effective job. I was invited by Senator Dianne Feinstein to testify in a Senate hearing. And last Thursday evening, I got a call saying that the Secretary of Defense had prohibited me from testifying, so I will not be appearing at the hearing tomorrow.
I'm surprised they're letting you talk to me.
I am, too. You know, they were notified, and no one ever objected, so I'm pleased to be here with you.
You know, defenders of the Pentagon would say that military commissions are devoid, to think that military commissions are devoid of politics is naive.
It is. I mean, I think there is a certain element. I mean, it's, you know, this is part of a governmental function, so there is an element of politics in it. But it's politics should not be the end result. You know, the outcome of a trial. And again, I don't know the particulars of what happened with Hicks, but if it is as many claim, then you know, trying to use the process in order to affect a political outcome is not what justice is all about.
No one's asked you to help them change things. So there won't be more resignations?
No. No one's asked.
Okay, Morris Davis, thanks for speaking with me.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
Colonel Morris Davis resigned as the chief prosecutor of the military commissions at Guantanamo Bay in October. He is now the director of the U.S. Air Force Judiciary. The Current called the Pentagon and requested a comment on Colonel Davis's allegations. Commander Jeffrey Gordon, a Pentagon spokesman, declined to comment, citing the fact that Colonel Davis no longer works with the military commissions. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at thecurrent, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.